Greetings, my Beyond the Care podcast family. I am your host, Dr. Paula. Welcome to today's episode. Today we will hear from a family physician who practices geriatric medicine, and we'll also have a discussion on the importance of clinical trials, especially in a Black community. This is such an important topic, and as always, I hope that something that you hear or something that is said resonates with you along your caregiving journey. So sit back, take notes, and pay attention to this important conversation. Thank you. Greetings, my Beyond the Care podcast family. Today I have Dr. Ritu Sori. Welcome, Dr. Sori. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. Let me just read a little bit about your bio, and I'm only going to read a little bit or we'll be here all day. Dr. Sori is Chief of Family Practice at Inglewood Hospital. She's board certified in family medicine, geriatric medicine, and hospice and palliative medicine. She specializes in primary care and geriatrics, in particular, the treatment of dementia. She participates in clinical research and has lectured across the region on palliative care and hospice. She is the past president of the Bergen Indian Medical Association and president-elect of New Jersey Long-Term Care Coalition and New Jersey American Medical Directors Association. She is a member of the American Association of Physician Leaders, New Jersey Academy of Family Physicians, American Academy of Family Physicians, and National Assisted Living Committee at the AMDA. She maintains a private practice in Inglewood, New Jersey, and is also a principal investigator for clinical trials at the Clinical Research Center of New Jersey. What an impressive background.
Thank you, Paula.
Dr. Sori, I just want to start with your background. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into geriatric medicine?
So, geriatrics, any private practice, primary care, especially 40 to 60% of your patient population is geriatrics. Mm-hmm. And you got to learn more because they definitely need a different set of care and rules than the younger population. So I think it is truly important for everyone to learn the geriatric principles of medicine. So that is how I got into it.
Okay. So looking at your geriatric patients, how do you bring up, I know your background, your specialty is dementia, cognitive illnesses. How do you bring up cognitive concerns with the family and the patient?
So a lot of times the family members will bring it up when it is become a little bit harder for them to handle. And they will notice these changes, but they might not bring it up early enough, but they will bring it up eventually when it starts bothering them. And it is harder for them to handle. But we have a very good opportunity as in primary care, during our annual wellness visits. We do memory screening. It is a requirement, part of the wellness visit, and Medicare pays for it. So we do owe it to our patients and population to be able to do that mini testing. It's called a mini cog. It takes less than 3 minutes to complete. Mm-hmm. It is based on recall and some of the executive functioning that you need to detect early to then go on to do a further testing on patients. Otherwise, patients that I've had a relationship with, that I've known for a long time, I can see these subtle changes and right. I can bring it up as well. There are a lot of patients that are new to the practice, they'll come in and I can bring up to the family, I can make them recognize that there are some changes that are happening. I might not label it the first visit, and it might take me, good 2 to 3 visits by the time I have a rapport and relationship and, have done the investigation. But you do see it as a clinician, and, you just actually have to be mindful and, try to pay attention, and you will see the changes that a person goes through.
Okay. So you mentioned executive function. Can you just share with the audience what do you mean by executive function or loss of executive functions?
Yes. So executive functioning is things like, planning a dinner party, paying your bills on time, balancing your checkbook, driving to your workplace or beyond, going to visit your family, and going to do run your errands. So all of these multi-step processes, they're all the executive functioning. And that is truly how we in the world are functioning and are productive, right? So this is where our life is. This is what gives meaning to our life. Like we are organizing and functioning that, whether it's in workplace, whether it is at home. So all of those, as early as, they say 3 to 5 to 4 years before you actually get diagnosed, you've actually started to lose these executive functioning. And
That's a little scary.
it is a little scary. It is actually, what happens is a lot of times the spouse or the family will take over. They'll say, "Oh, mom can't handle the checkbook. I'll take it over.
And
The
these are
spouse
things that are
starts to do
usually
it."
familiar with, you're familiar
Yeah,
with.
and then they think it's normal part of aging, but it is not normal part of aging. And they'll say, "Oh, okay, you know what? Mom can't drive to my sister's, so I'll drive my mom to my sister's." But it is a question of why is mom not able to drive when she was able to do it before? And then why is mom saying, "I'm not interested in doing this," when she was very interested in doing these kind of things? Like she was very interested in organizing a dinner for the whole family. And now she's like, "I don't want to do it." Why is she not wanting to do it? Is it that she's not able to do it? Or she's not able to think about the whole
That.
process?
Okay.
How is she going to get to the grocery store? How much is she going to buy? How is she going to prepare? How many dishes is she going to prepare? How many people are coming? So all of those, the logistics of doing all of those things. And a lot of people think my mom doesn't want to do it because she's depressed. Or my mom is getting older. That's why she doesn't want to do it. So a lot of people will get either labeled as depression or normal aging. And the diagnosis keeps getting delayed.
So, how do you determine a difference between normal aging and dementia?
So the same thing, it is when you drive, and if you're driving to a new place, it's easy to forget, right? You might lose a lane. Now with Waze and Google Maps, it's very hard to do. But people who are losing their executive functioning might not even be able to follow Waze and Google Maps. But the most important thing is losing direction when you are going to a familiar place. You are going to a post office and you get a call from a cop that your mom was found, 3 miles from wherever she was supposed to be. That's a warning sign. When your mom was bills are not getting paid, or mom is paying twice the amount, or the bank is calling you saying, your mom's bank account is the checks are bouncing because there is no money left in the bank, or the electricity is cut
It's
off
getting cut
because
off, right?
because the bills have not been paid. So all of these things are not normal parts of aging. And the other piece is that when somebody is depressed, you do think but they feel sad and they feel that this depression is taking away from their life. But when somebody has apathy, which is what happens in patients with dementia, they'll tell you, "I don't care." And actually, they don't care. It doesn't bother them that they're not going out anymore. It doesn't bother them that their grandchildren are visiting them and they have no interest in being with them. It doesn't bother them that, no family member is coming to visit them. Or even their own hygiene. It doesn't bother them that they are not maintaining their own hygiene. Or so all of these things are not normal.
And these sound like more drastic changes within the
Exactly.
person. How do you diag you talked a little bit about the mini cog. What are some of the other tests, or how do you diagnose dementia?
So MiniCOG is only a screening tool, and it really is telling us that we need to do further investigation. So there are a lot of tests that we can do in the office. You know, there is AMOCA, which is, you know, one of the tests that we use in the office. It tells us about, it checks on the executive functioning, it checks on your memory, it checks on your orientation, it checks on your language. So it is, it's an overall test. It's a very, it takes 15 minutes to do in the office, and that guides us, you know, on what further testing you need. So there are several kinds of dementia. So the testing depends on, after you've done this basic testing, on what is the direction you're going to take. And also, you know, there are several kinds of dementia. So the testing for vascular, if you're thinking vascular, is, you know, let's do an MRI, find out if she's had many strokes. If it's frontotemporal, like what are the symptoms of frontotemporal? Like, is it apathy? Is it, you know, mood changes, personality changes? If it's Lewy body dementia, are the person hallucinating? Is there a gait disturbance? You know, if it's Alzheimer's, now we are lucky we have a blood test, we have a genetic test, we have an amyloid PET. That aid us in diagnosing Alzheimer's, and then obviously clinical signs and symptoms. So it is, we also have computerized executive functioning testing, which detects us earlier. So all of this testing is something that you can do in the office, and then, you know, supplement it with an MRI, an amyloid PET, you know, or whatever else is needed. So there's extensive testing available now.
Okay, and if someone wanted to get tested, they would just go to their primary care physician and say, I want to be tested
Absolutely.
for dementia.
Absolutely. That would be the first place to start.
Okay, is there any age, anything we should look for before we say, something's a little different here. I think I should get mom
So
tested, or I want to get tested myself.
the first thing is that there is no age barrier. But yes, after 50 is more likely that you will have symptoms. There is definitely early onset dementia, and those patients unfortunately don't get diagnosed for several years before they, you know, before they start treatment. And it's unfortunate because, you know, there is obviously stigma around it. There's also labeling off, you know, this person just doesn't care. This person is lazy. This person, you know, is manipulative. This person has a psychiatric illness. So there's so many other diagnoses
Factors.
that come up before the person gets diagnosed. But truly speaking, that there is no age as such, but 50 onwards, one should be careful and think about brain health as much as you think about your heart health. And so, you know, whatever you do for your heart health needs to be done for your brain health, but there are certain other things that we say that need to be done for your brain health.
And what is
So
that? That was my next question. So you might as well
the
go into that. What can we do to improve,
so
maintain our brain health?
so first and foremost, I cannot, you know, say more about it is sleep. Sleep is critical. It is critical.
There I go.
And
It's over for me.
so sleep is critical, and a good night's sleep is very good, important. So I always say, you know, shut off your screens an hour, at least an hour before. You know, cool your room down to at least 66 to 68 degree. You know, listen to soft music or read if you want to. Yellow light is okay, but the white light is not okay. And try and sleep. And if you really can't sleep, then, you know, use melatonin, try melatonin an hour or two before you go to sleep and see how it will help you. It's a naturally occurring hormone and it is really good. The problem is people say, I don't sleep and I'm going to take a sleeping aid. Sleeping aids are linked to early onset of dementia. So believe me, they're addictive. Yes, they're addictive and 50% increased chance of dementia. So they are not the answer to not sleeping well.
Wow, that's good to
They are
know.
not. They are not. So it is truly important that, you know, people try to keep a sleep diary, work on their sleep hygiene, and sleep well. So that is my number one. I always say that. Second is good nutrition, trying to keep a diet, which is, we always say Mediterranean diet has always shown to be good for heart health. It is also good for your brain health. So third is physical activity. Get moving. It is not about 10,000 steps. It is truly about, being able to raise your heart rate, being able to, get out in the sun, just exposing yourself to the sun in the morning, especially in the morning. I don't want my seniors out between 11 and 4, please. I don't want you dehydrated, but before 11, after 4, get moving. That is very important. Actually, socialization has been seen to be the most important thing for your brain health. So socializing, having small talk, meeting new people, going places, all of that is very important. And fifth is actually learning something new. So if you're a dancer, new dance routine. If you are a gymnast, a new routine for that. If you like to plant, finding other plants and doing other ways to plant stuff. Whatever your hobbies are, learning something new is very, very important. Very, very important.
I remember when my mom had dementia, they said to do activities like puzzles and
Absolutely.
things like that. I've taken up Sudoku in the last couple of weeks, so that's my new hobby, Sudoku. Hopefully that'll help with my
I'll
brain
tell
health
you.
since I'm not sleeping my, what, 6 to 8 hours.
No, but believe me, all of these game the games help, and because if somebody, but I think it promotes more sedentary lifestyle. I'd rather say that get out and do something. Games are great. I mean, they are good because they keep our brain active, they keep us thinking. They also, it's strategy. It's also strategy, so it's good. But it is important to get out and learn something new.
So you mentioned about stigma. I wanted to just something just came into my mind. You know, when we're looking primarily at the African American community, there's a lot of stigma in knowing certain diseases or things. How do you deal with not only the stigma, but also with the person who's diagnosed with dementia? How do you say to them, you know, you're now losing your cognitive function? What does that do to a person to hear that?
So I will be honest with you. I think obviously I do this a lot, and a lot of times initially when the person comes in and the family comes, they come in, there is that wall that they don't want you to pierce, because it is, they're being stoic about it. It's hard to listen that there is something going on. But when you actually finally make the diagnosis, it is a relief for a lot of people.
Because you can finally figure out what's going
Because
on.
exactly. And it is truly about, they've actually seen it going through. They just couldn't put a name to it. And there is that fear of what's going to happen, the fear to know. It's the fear of the unknown. But once the whole thing is out and we've declared it, we also, you just don't throw a diagnosis at someone. You actually are care planning around that diagnosis. It is not just about the medical stuff. Okay, the medical stuff is over now. You have a diagnosis. Now, what is
Now, what's
next?
next, right?
And if you're ready to hold that patient's hand and that family's hand and take them through that journey, what it is going to look like in the next few years, how you need to plan, what you need to plan for, what to expect, I think it makes it a lot easier for them. Yes, that initial hesitation is really there. And it is definitely much more common in Asian communities like mine, the African American and the Hispanic community. We are always like, we'll face it when it comes. But in this particular disease, planning early will be truly essential because we have a lot of things that we can offer now, I couldn't say this. I couldn't say this 2 years ago, but now we have a lot of studies that are ongoing. So early detection can get them into a study. And as studies are being conducted on already approved medications, which are very expensive, but and a lot of folks can't afford them. But if you're in a study, a lot of that cost is taken
Taken
care of
care
by the study. So you're getting FDA-approved drugs, but you're getting it also covered at the same time, which is a lot, but it's a big benefit for a lot of our patient populations. So that is why I really focus on early detection because I think I can help people get into studies. Or if they are further along than in the disease process, we do have a lot of programs coming out of CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they have the new GUIDE program, which is a lot of good social support for the families, and and holding their hands on how to go through this journey, not alone, but surrounded by professionals.
Well,
So that
that's
is
key.
truly,
So you said studies. And I really want to get into this topic. And by
Sure.
studies, you mean clinical trials.
Clinical trials, yes.
Yes. And we know, and I'm primarily focused on the African American community,
Sure.
dating back to the Tuskegee experiments.
Exactly,
There is
exactly.
a huge mistrust when we hear the word clinical trials. Nope, I'm not going to do
Absolutely.
it. I don't want to get involved. Let's talk about the importance of participating in clinical trials and how do we overcome this mistrust and why it's so important that African Americans and other communities that don't have the same level of trust for clinical trials get involved.
So yes, there is obviously a huge background to this, and I don't blame them. And again, when I'm talking to my patient population, I absolutely have to be very sensitive about it. And I have to be very clear, I was not aware of this up until 20 years ago when as my kids were growing up and they made me aware of this. And excuse me, I grew up in India, so I had not studied American history, but as my kids were studying American history, I learned a lot about it, and I am very sensitive to it. But
Every black person will tell you about the Tuskegee experiment. Yes,
yes,
it's a
yes.
huge deal in our community.
Absolutely. And you know what? You have the right to feel the way you do, but I think I can tell you that in today's day and age, there is so much red tape, in fact, I would say, which is very good. And it has been put in place for this reason, because we do not want to be abusing or misusing any person or animal for the clinical trials, right? And that is the whole point of it. We are, all of this. We go through different stages. I had to go through a lot of training myself, and we being very sensitive about what can be and what should be happening when we enroll somebody. So it is the other piece of this, what I want to educate everybody, it's not just African American, it's also the Asian community, just ours, the Hispanic community. We are very hesitant to go into the clinical trials, but we also have to realize we are getting medications that were never tested on our population. So we don't know if this medication is actually going to work for us or not. So yes, it sounds like that I should be a guinea pig for my future generations. It is not being a guinea pig. You are being supported, monitored vigilantly through the entire process. There is a full informed consent and complete transparency, and you can drop out of it at any time if you feel like that this is not meant for you. But if we don't get enrolled in the studies ourselves, then our future generations will not know whether these medications that we are getting for the diseases that we are being treated for, are they actually even effective, or just we're just because we were never tested for this.
Right.
You know, most of the trials have less than 3% of the population that is minority or, you know, so how do you know that this is going to work for us? Because our genetic makeups are different. I mean, there are
Absolutely.
certain diseases that are more prominent in our cultures. And how do you correlate? So I think we owe it to our future generations that we need to be an active participant. We actually need to at least first start learning about it and then say, no, I'm not going to participate in it, or yes, I will participate in it. But at least get involved in learning about it, I would
Right.
say.
And that's, you said three, less than 3% of African
Yes.
Americans. Wow, that's a startling statistic. Not surprising, though. Again,
Yes.
not surprising, but very startling. So you are the clinical researcher at the Cognitive and Research Center of New Jersey. Tell
Yes.
us a little bit about that role and maybe what clinical trials that you have going on right now.
So at the CRCNJ in you know, we have two offices. One is in Springfield and one is in Ridgewood. I'm at the Ridgewood Center in Bergen County. We are a clinical trial site. We are performing trials on Alzheimer's, you know, the early detection and preclinical levels of, because we know that Alzheimer's, by the time it has presented, we've had that disease for almost 20 years prior. So now we know
That's
that.
amazing.
So we are doing studies on patients who have no clinical manifestation of Alzheimer's but are predisposed to Alzheimer's. And we are doing studies on early Alzheimer's. And there is another study that is being done on just Trontier, which is it's a traveler study, which is a precursor to the Trontier study. We are trying to get blood biomarkers on those patients to see if they will be eligible for the other future studies. And we are trying to tap into both. There are two kinds of proteins that are a problem in Alzheimer's. One is the amyloid and the other one is tau. So there are two, both the studies going on for both of those at the current time. And I have to tell you that there is studies that are going on with medications that are already approved, FDA approved. There are two medications that are already approved for early Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment that are in the market but are very expensive. And we also have a lot of physicians who are not sure, you know, because they're relatively new. So a lot of physicians don't talk about them. But we are studying those medications with little modifications to minimize side effects. And again, you know, it is free for the person, and they don't have to pay anything. So I would encourage a lot of patients to get enrolled in that study.
All right, I want to come back to enrollment in the studies, but I just want to touch on something that you mentioned, that you're predisposed 20 years before you're actually diagnosed with Alzheimer's. That's a little scary. In my mind, I'm just thinking my mom had dementia. So does that mean I'm pre-exposed? And what are some of
So
the factors?
again, so not that because your mom had it that you're going to get it. Again, it does depend on her individual risk factors. You know, whether she had high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, all the metabolic disorders, you know, overweight, smoking, alcohol, you know. Again, the medication used that I was talking about, the benzodiazepines, the sleep aids, the Benadryls of the world. So, a lot of these other factors contribute to the Alzheimer's or other dementias. And the other factor is that I actually personally have patients in my office who are in their 90s and have the genetic marker for Alzheimer's and are doing functionally phenomenally. And you know, and it is primarily because one of them is a marathon runner, right? Runs 50 marathons a year, is very physically active, his lifestyle is conducive to really a healthy living, right? He's eating very well, he's exercising, focusing on his sleep, and he may or may not have the genetic marker, but he has done extremely well for himself.
Lifestyle changes.
I have another patient who was a tap dancer. She's 94 right now. She was tap dancing up until last year. And she has the genetic marker, but fully functional. She's still living alone, doing everything that she can do for herself. So it's critical. It is modifiable to an extent, and you can delay the onset. It is truly important that your lifestyle really depends, determines where you land up. Again, people miss hearing loss is also a big risk factor for dementia.
Wow, that's the first
Hearing
I've ever
loss,
heard of that.
yes. So hearing loss causes you to isolate yourself, and you're not having the conversations, you're not going out, you're
Got
in a
it.
gathering, but you're not participating.
I can see
And
it.
that all of that contributes to your getting dementia as well. So there are a lot of factors, and you have to be, cognizant of that as well. Yes, there is a test to tell you that if you're genetically predisposed to it, but that is not the end all
Only
be all.
test. Yeah, I see the correlation with some of the things you mentioned. Interesting. So let's go back to clinical trials. You mentioned some of the clinical trials in your office that you're working on. If someone watching this podcast was interested, how could they reach out to you? How could they learn more about the clinical trials?
So what we're going to do is we'll share our information with
Yes.
you, and we have a Facebook page, we are on Instagram, the CRCNJ. We'll share the link with you. Please, come in. You'll have a very pleasant experience, I guarantee you that. It's not intimidating at all. You can just come in and say you want to get memory tested. We'll do free memory screenings. And you know what? If you are eligible for a study, we'll let you know. If you're interested, only then we move forward. There is no forcing anyone to move forward with a study. But a free memory screening is worth getting, I think.
Free
We
memory
also
screen.
have studies on, for metabolic associated liver disease right now, which is the not we used to be called the non-alcoholic liver disease, the liver cirrhosis. We have studies on that, on how to modify and not land up on being a cirrhotic. So we have that, and the risk factors for that are very much the same. Hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, morbid obesity, all of those same risk factors that you have for dementia, very much the same. We are doing free FibroScan screenings to let you know if you have liver disease. So please come in. When you come in, we can do both. Again, complete transparency and informed consent if you want to proceed with the clinical trial. There is no forcing anyone to do it.
And I think that's the key, one of the key takeaways, if anyone is interested in clinical trials, that there's complete transparency. That's the
Absolutely.
expectation, that there's complete
Absolutely.
transparency. And hopefully that will dispel some of the mistrust.
Absolutely. I'm hoping so too.
What are your, let's say, three key takeaways from this discussion? It can be about clinical trials, dementia, brain health. I have so many gems that you shared this today. So, what are your three gems or takeaways that you'd like to share with the audience?
I think the number one is sleep. I don't know what else to focus on, but sleep is the time, is the actual time when your brain really rests and it needs to clear away its own toxins. That is the only time. Please give it that rest that it deserves. That
I feel like you're talking
is
to
my
me
number
directly.
one. Number two is keep moving. Focus on early detection. Knowing is better than not knowing because you will be able to get access to a lot to you.
So you said
Yeah.
sleep, and
Yeah.
activity. And what
So
was the
early detection.
early detection? Okay. Early detection. Okay.
Third
And
one is early detection. You know,
Got
if
it.
you feel something is not right, talk to your primary care physician.
Okay.
And then, because the early detection will help you enroll in studies or get access to other resources in the community, either way.
Awesome. Okay. This has been extremely informative. Wow. I really learned a lot during this discussion. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to have you on again because I think we just touched the surface of so many things, but we probably can go on
Thank
in
you.
depth about so many more things that you talked about. Dr. Sori, thank you so much. You're with the Cognitive and
Thank
Research Center of New Jersey. We will share the contact information, how to get in touch with the organization, and more about the clinical trials that you have going on. Thank you again. I appreciate your time.
You're
And
very welcome.
yes, I'm sure, as it has done for me, that something you said has really reached someone who's listening to this podcast, and that you have changed many lives just from the information you provided. So
I hope so. I hope so.
thank you, Dr.
Thank you.
Story, and thank you, Beyond the
Thank
Care
you.
podcast audience.
Thank you.